Hello, this is Chris Wilhelm, and for the next hour, I'll be reading from the Friday, December 5th issue of the New York Times on the Niagara Frontier Radio Reading Service. Our first article today, Supreme Court clears the way for Republican-friendly Texas voting maps. Texas officials had asked the court to allow the state to use the new maps in the midterm elections, part of a push by President Trump to gain a partisan advantage. By Abby Van Sickle. The Supreme Court cleared the way on Thursday for Texas lawmakers to use newly redrawn congressional maps favoring Republicans in the 2026 midterm elections. The decision overturns, at least for now, a lower court ruling that the new maps were likely an unconstitutional racial gerrymander. That decision had blocked lawmakers from using the maps in the midterms. The Supreme Court's order comes days before a December 8th deadline for candidates to file to run for office in Texas. It marks a victory for Texas Republicans and for President Trump, who has pushed Republican-led states to revise their congressional maps to try to secure GOP victories in the midterms. The ruling also adds to the growing list of successes for the Trump administration before the justices, particularly on their emergency docket of cases heard without oral arguments, where the court's orders are intended to be merely interim. Critics refer to it as the shadow docket and note that temporary decisions can have broad consequences. In a five-paragraph order, the majority wrote that Texas was likely to succeed on the merits of its claim that a lower court had wrongly blocked the new maps. The trial court, the majority wrote, had improperly inserted itself into an active primary campaign, causing much confusion and upsetting the delicate federal-state balance in elections. The court's order did not include a vote count, which is typical for rulings on such emergency applications. Justice Samuel A. Alito, Jr. wrote a concurrence, adding that he joined the majority's decision to allow the Texas maps. Two other conservative justices, Clarence Thomas and Neil M. Gorsuch, joined him. In a 17-page dissent, Justice Elena Kagan, joined by the court's two other liberals, argued that the majority had wrongly overturned a careful 160-page lower court ruling based on its perusal over a holiday weekend of a cold paper record. We are a higher court than the district court, but we are not a better one when it comes to making such a fact-based decision, she wrote. Justice Kagan wrote that the Supreme Court's order disserves the millions of Texans whom the district court found were assigned to their new districts based on their race, adding that because this court's precedents and our Constitution demand better, I respectfully dissent. The ruling outlines the state of play while litigation over the map continues through the lower courts, including potentially returning to the Supreme Court for further consideration. But given the deadline, the order means the map will be used for the key 2026 vote. In recent months, Mr. Trump has pushed Republican-led states to swiftly redraw their congressional maps ahead of the 2026 elections to try to fend off the possibility of Democrats winning control of the House. If Democrats gain the House majority, they could investigate Mr. Trump's administration and otherwise stymie his agenda. Attorney General Ken Paxton of Texas cheered the decision, writing in a statement that the state was paving the way as we take our country back, district by district, state by state. Derek Johnson, the president of the NAACP, one of the groups that sued to challenge the Texas maps, said in a statement that the move to redraw maps mid-decade is clearly racially motivated, accusing Mr. Trump of working with his supporters to rig the system to try and steal votes from black and brown Americans. In a statement, Ken Martin, the chairman of the Democratic National Committee, said the court's decision was wrong, both morally and legally. The mid-cycle redistricting push outside the political norm is at the center of Mr. Trump's midterm strategy. It has set off similar redistricting efforts in Democratic-led states like California. Governor Gavin Newsom, a Democrat, championed a ballot measure to allow California to redraw its congressional map. The state's voters passed the measure, clearing the way for Mr. Newsom's plan. Texas officials helped set off the national redistricting fight. In August, Governor Greg Abbott signed a law that redrew maps for that state's 38 congressional districts, creating 5 new seats that favored Republicans. Civil rights groups sued to challenge the map, asserting that the lawmakers had engaged in racial gerrymandering, preventing minority voters from being able to select their candidates of choice. In November, a divided panel of the 3 judges in Texas blocked the state's map from going into effect. In a 2-to-1 decision written by Judge Jeffrey V. Brown, a district judge for the U.S. District Court for the Southern District of Texas and a Trump appointee, the panel issued a preliminary finding that sided with the civil rights groups. In an extraordinary dissent, Judge Jerry E. Smith, a judge on the U.S. Court of Appeals for the 5th Circuit and a Reagan appointee, railed at his colleagues, accusing Judge Brown of pernicious judicial misbehavior. Judge Smith accused the majority of publishing its decision before he had finished his dissent. Judge Smith also argued that the decision to redraw the lines was all politics on both sides of the partisan aisle. The Supreme Court has said lawmakers may draw maps for partisan advantage, provided they do not discriminate on the basis of race. He asserted that George Soros, the wealthy philanthropist known for championing left-leaning causes, was involved in challenging the maps. On November 21st, Texas officials filed an emergency application to the Supreme Court, asking the justices to step in and allow the state to use its new map. In a brief to the court, Mr. Paxton argued that politics, not race, had motivated the change to congressional district lines. This summer, the Texas legislature did what legislatures do, politics, Mr. Paxton wrote, asking the court to move swiftly to block the lower court order. He asked the court to rule by December 1st, citing the candidate filing deadline. Justice Samuel A. Alito, Jr., who is assigned to handle emergency applications from that region of the country, stepped in later that day, temporarily blocking the lower court ruling, in what is known as an administrative stay, and setting a swift briefing schedule leading to Thursday's ruling. Grand jury said to decline to re-indict Letitia James. After a judge dismissed the Trump administration's first attempt to indict the Attorney General of New York State, a new grand jury effort failed, according to people familiar with the matter. By Devlin Barrett and Jonah E. Bromwich. A grand jury in Norfolk, Virginia, declined on Thursday to re-indict Letitia James, New York's Attorney General, according to people familiar with the matter, rejecting efforts to revive a criminal case that had been sought by President Trump. The decision dealt another embarrassing setback to the president's efforts to exert greater control over the Justice Department, highlighting how judges and jurors have acted as a check on Mr. Trump's desire to use the criminal justice system to punish his political foes. But the unsuccessful attempt does not necessarily end the administration's efforts to put Ms. James on trial. Nothing in the law prevents the Justice Department from trying again to indict her. Still, the grand jury's rejection came more than a week after a federal judge dismissed an earlier indictment against Ms. James, ruling that Lindsay Halligan, the prosecutor handpicked by Mr. Trump to bring the case, had been unlawfully appointed. The Justice Department declined to comment. In a statement, a lawyer for Ms. James, Abby D. Lowell, called the grand jury's refusal a decisive rejection of a case that should never have existed in the first place. "This should be the end of this case," he said. "If they continue, undeterred by a court ruling and a grand jury's rejection of the charges, it will be a shocking assault on the rule of law." In a statement, Ms. James thanked the members of the grand jury, saying it's time for the weaponization of our justice system to stop. The case in Virginia is not the only one Mr. Trump's Justice Department has opened into Ms. James, underscoring the president's long-standing enmity toward her. Ms. James has been in the president's crosshairs largely because of her years-long civil case, in which she accused him of exaggerating his net worth by billions of dollars. The original indictment centered on Ms. James' purchase of a home in Norfolk in 2020, and whether she lied to financial institutions to get a discounted mortgage rate for the property. Roger Keller, a federal prosecutor brought in from Missouri to handle the case after career lawyers determined the evidence was too weak to support charges, presented a new version of the indictment on Thursday, according to people familiar with the matter who spoke on the condition of anonymity to describe events intended to be kept private. Shortly after 9 a.m., grand jurors convened on the fourth floor of the Walter E. Hoffman Courthouse, a marble-halled building in downtown Norfolk. A court security officer guarded the room where they met. Their deliberations seemed to be brief and uncomplicated, and by lunchtime, the jurors appeared to have adjourned. In September, Mr. Trump forced out his own choice for U.S. Attorney in the Eastern District of Virginia, Eric S. Siebert, after Mr. Siebert concluded the evidence did not warrant criminal charges against Ms. James or another of Mr. Trump's frequent targets, the former FBI director, James B. Comey. The president installed Ms. Halligan, a White House aide with no prosecutorial experience, in Mr. Siebert's place. Days later, Ms. Halligan secured a grand jury indictment against Mr. Comey and weeks later against Ms. James. Judge Cameron McGowan Curry ruled in late November that Ms. Halligan's interim appointment was invalid because such appointments were meant to last no more than 120 days, a period exceeded by the previous interim appointee, Mr. Siebert. And because Ms. Halligan was the sole prosecutor who had secured charges against Mr. Comey and Ms. James, Judge Curry ruled the indictments had to be thrown out. Judge Curry did not weigh in on the evidence against Ms. James, which career prosecutors in the Eastern District of Virginia had viewed skeptically. Ms. Bondi quickly vowed to appeal the decision. Even as a federal grand jury in Virginia voted down a new indictment, lawyers representing Ms. James' office appeared before a federal judge in Albany, New York, where the Justice Department is pursuing a separate civil rights investigation into her work as the state's top lawyer. Lawyers for Ms. James' office are seeking to block the investigation. That appearance also appeared to have gone poorly for the government. The judge, Lorna G. Schofield, expressed skepticism about whether the interim U.S. attorney overseeing that case was lawfully appointed by the administration, an issue that is becoming increasingly difficult for the president in his quest to use the Justice Department to seek retribution. While the government sought to argue that the unusual appointment of that U.S. attorney, John A. Sarkoni III, was a technicality, a lawyer for Ms. James' office, Halen J. Chen, strongly disagreed, quoting a concurring opinion from Justice Clarence Thomas about the importance of following the law with appointments. Federal judges have repeatedly ruled against Mr. Trump's use of interim appointments to skirt the Senate confirmation process required for U.S. attorneys, as Ms. Chen pointed out to the judge in Albany on Thursday. A three-judge appeals court panel in Philadelphia ruled on Monday that the Trump administration's efforts to extend the tenure of Alina Haba, the interim U.S. attorney in New Jersey and a former personal lawyer for Mr. Trump, were also unlawful and invalid. As health care subsidies teeter, Congress is again at an impasse. Democrats won an agreement for a floor showdown after the shutdown, but consensus still eludes the Senate. Will Republicans pay a political price? By Carl Hulse. When a handful of Democrats broke with their party last month to join Republicans in ending the longest government shutdown in history, they cheered a promise they had extracted from the GOP that Congress would soon have the opportunity to extend the expiring health care subsidies that had been at the heart of the fight. But 1 week out from a Senate vote on the matter, there appears to be no viable path to doing so. Instead, history appears to be repeating itself on Capitol Hill, where disruptive shutdowns often end with the promise of action on the contentious issue that caused them, only to tee up a failed vote that yields no resolution. That was the case back in 2018, when Democrats demanded a bill to protect certain undocumented immigrants from deportation as a condition of funding the government. Republicans refused, and the government briefly shut down before Democrats relented, enticed by a GOP promise to hold future votes on an immigration measure. But neither party's proposal could pass, and no progress was made on the issue. It could be deja vu next week with the health care subsidies. With most Republicans opposed to the expiring tax credits, the 60 votes needed to approve an extension do not exist in the Senate, and it is not clear that any proposal could make it to the floor in the House. Democrats believe, though, that there is a big difference between the most recent shutdown and the one they engineered a little under 8 years ago when they abruptly ended it after realizing public sentiment was not on their side. This time, they argue, the risky strategy of shutting down the government to put a spotlight on health care costs has paid off in a way that Republicans will ignore to their political peril in next year's midterm elections. It's different than any other shutdown because we forced them to debate on our turf, and they lost a dramatic amount of ground. Senator Chuck Schumer, Democrat of New York and the majority leader, said in an interview, "They are just stuck." Republicans deny that they are in a tough spot and say it is Democrats who will feel the political pain for having instigated a shutdown that did considerable damage to government institutions and Americans who rely on government services. They condemn Democrats' bid to bolster any part of the Affordable Care Act, given that its costs are soaring, and have said major changes are needed, though they have yet to propose any. They caused massive pain, Senator John Barrasso of Wyoming, the number two Republican, said of Democrats, and they got nothing for it. Democrats, he added, are seeking 3 more years of COVID bonus payments without a change to the law, not a single reform to deal with the waste, the fraud, the abuse, and the corruption of these payments of Obamacare. Members of both parties in both chambers have been engaged in talks aimed at finding legislation that could pass the Senate and avoid a rise in premiums under the 2010 health law when the tax breaks enacted by Democrats during the pandemic expire at the end of the year. But no agreement has emerged. "I don't think at this point we have a clear path forward," Senator John Thune, Republican of South Dakota and the majority leader, told reporters this week. In the absence of bipartisan agreement, Mr. Schumer on Thursday announced that Democrats would use their promised floor time next week to push a 3-year extension on the subsidies. "Republicans have 1 week to decide where they stand," Mr. Schumer said on the Senate floor. "Vote for this bill and bring health care costs down, or block this bill and send premiums skyrocketing." Despite that Democratic framing, the proposal is a non-starter for most Republicans, who at minimum want to tighten eligibility for tax credits and allow a shorter extension, if they do anything at all. "I don't see any way under the sun that we would support an extension of the current broken system," said Senator John Cornyn, a veteran Texas Republican up for re-election next year. "We know that the cost trajectory is unsustainable." Strenuous opposition also exists among House Republican leaders to renewing the subsidies, and it is unclear if the House would take up legislation should the Senate pass something. When President Trump hinted recently that he might be ready to reach some agreement with Democrats to extend the subsidies and avoid political fallout, Republican leaders quickly talked him out of the idea, and the White House has been mostly silent on the issue since. Some Republican senators believe action is needed now or early next year to avoid a spike in insurance costs or people dropping coverage altogether. A bipartisan push has also emerged in the House, where a group of Republicans and Democrats released a proposal on Thursday for a 2-year extension that would scale back the subsidies. "As I see it, we have no choice but to modify and extend these tax credits to get us some time to find a permanent solution to this pressing problem," Senator Lisa Murkowski, Republican of Alaska, said on Wednesday. But for now, no deal to do so has emerged, leaving Congress without a path forward as Americans face price increases and lawmakers look toward midterm elections. Mr. Schumer argued in the interview that his strategy to center the shutdown fight on the subsidies has set Democrats up to benefit regardless of whether they succeed in winning an extension. With voters focused on affordability and Republicans already on the defensive for imposing steep cuts to Medicaid in their sweeping tax cut law, he said, it has been clear to him that health care ought to be the tip of the spear. "So we ended up on our front foot," Mr. Schumer said of his party's position on health care, "and they ended up really hurting with the American people." You are listening to a reading of articles and features from the New York Times on the Niagara Frontier Radio Reading Service. Takeaways from the Pentagon investigation on Hegseth's use of Signal. The Inspector General concluded that the Defense Secretary violated the Pentagon's instructions on using a private electronic device to share sensitive information, by John Ismay. The Defense Department's Inspector General's Office concluded in a report released on Thursday that Defense Secretary Pete Hegseth did not comply with the Pentagon's policies when he used a private messaging app to discuss upcoming airstrikes by U.S. forces in Yemen earlier this year. Mr. Hegseth sent non-public information that identified the quantity and strike times of manned U.S. aircraft over hostile territory over an unapproved, unsecure network approximately 2 to 4 hours before the execution of those strikes, the report said. The information was shared with Mr. Hegseth in a secure email from U.S. Central Command, which executed the strikes against Houthi forces on March 15th. The report notes that Central Command's message marked that email as secret no-forn, meaning that its contents could not be disclosed to foreign nationals, and according to the Pentagon's definition, their release could cause serious damage to operations, assets, or individuals. Here's what we learned from the report. Hegseth declined to be interviewed by the Inspector General's office. During the investigative process, Mr. Hegseth declined to be interviewed by the Inspector General's office. He instead submitted a statement on July 25th in response to investigators' questions. Mr. Hegseth acknowledged receiving information on March 14th from Central Command that was marked secret no-forn about the planned attacks, and said in his statement to investigators that he had shared only non-specific general details to create an unclassified summary for those in a Signal chat group. The people in that chat included Vice President J.D. Vance, Michael Waltz, then the National Security Advisor, and Senior White House Advisor Stephen Miller. Mr. Waltz had also mistakenly added Jeffrey Goldberg, the editor-in-chief of The Atlantic, to the group. Mr. Hegseth told the investigators that he had the authority to declassify military information. Investigators had to rely in part on The Atlantic's reporting. The Inspector General's office requested all of Mr. Hegseth's Signal messages, but noted that it was able to obtain only a partial accounting of the exchanges because the group chat's auto-delete function was turned on in the security settings. The investigators had to rely in part on Mr. Goldberg's published transcript of messages from the chat. The conversation included specific times that Navy warplane sorties would launch from an aircraft carrier in the region and when munitions were expected to hit their targets. The information would have been useful to the Houthis. The U.S. military typically classifies operational information of that sort as secret to preserve an element of surprise over an adversary. That information would also have been useful in targeting incoming U.S. aircraft had the Houthis, who have robust air defense radar and anti-aircraft missile capabilities, obtained it in advance. The only manned aircraft lost during the operation came when two Navy fighter jets fell off the aircraft carrier USS Harry S. Truman and sank in the Red Sea. The first was lost overboard after the crew lost control of the plane, according to officials at the time, and the second was lost trying to land on the ship. Hegseth was faulted for using a private cell phone. The Inspector General's report found that Mr. Hegseth had violated Pentagon instructions on using a private electronic device to share sensitive information. It added that Mr. Hegseth did so from a secure facility installed at his home on an Army base in Washington, while accompanied by his junior military assistant and his personal communicator. Reaction from Congress showed a partisan split. Before the report's public release, Senator Robert Wicker of Mississippi and the Republican chairman of the Senate Armed Services Committee said in a statement that the secretary acted within his authority. Mr. Wicker added, "It is also clear to me that our senior leaders need more tools available to them to communicate classified information in real time and a variety of environments. I think we have some work to do in providing those tools to our national security leaders," he said. The top Democrat on the committee, Senator Jack Reed of Rhode Island, had a different view. The report makes clear that Secretary Hegseth violated Defense Department policies and shared information that was classified at the time it was sent to him, Mr. Reed said in a statement before the Inspector General's report was publicly released. "These were precise strike timings and locations that, had they fallen into enemy hands, could have enabled the Houthis to target American pilots." The investigators recommended steps to facilitate secure mobile communication. In a companion report released on Thursday, the Inspector General's office offered recommendations concerning the Defense Department's handling of sensitive information. One recommendation said the Defense Department's Chief Information Officer should source and maintain a means of communication that the Pentagon controls for use on mobile devices like cell phones that would allow users to securely share classified information. Such a means of communication should also preserve messages in order to comply with government-wide requirements to protect information and preserve official records. So far, the report noted, the Chief Information Officer has not fully put into place that recommendation. The continued use of apps like Signal to transmit sensitive information among government employees could, the report says, jeopardize U.S. military operations or missions. Her roof was about to be fixed, then immigration agents showed up. The Trump administration's deportation agenda is reverberating beyond immigrant communities as agents begin fanning out around New Orleans. By Eduardo Medina. After Hurricane Francine damaged Althea Valiton's house in suburban New Orleans last year, puddles formed on her floors whenever it rained, but she saved up money and lived in a mobile home on her front lawn for months until she finally obtained a loan to pay for a stronger metallic covering. The cost? About $49,000. On Wednesday, several workers, hired by a legitimate contractor, she said, arrived around 7 a.m. and got to work on the roof. She, in turn, drove to her job at a nearby school, relieved that her home repair odyssey was ending. It was a one-day job, after all. Then her phone buzzed. Friends and relatives were asking if she had seen the videos online of federal immigration agents in Kenner, Louisiana, ordering the roof repairers to get down. Some sent screenshots of a masked agent pointing a weapon at the workers. They were at her house. Mrs. Valiton was stunned. She found the principal. "I gotta go now. ICE is at my house," she told her. By the time Ms. Valiton got home, the action was over, but she pieced together what had happened. The largely Hispanic construction crew on her roof had become the latest target of federal immigration crackdown that had arrived in New Orleans that morning. Episodes like this one are now playing out all over the country, revealing the ways that the Trump administration's deportation agenda is reverberating far beyond the immigrants whose lives are being upended. According to videos taken by neighbors, the agents, including several from the Border Patrol, had shown up and tried to detain the men, but they refused to get down from the roof. An hours-long standoff ensued. At one point, video shows agents climbed onto the garage roof and one of the workers appeared to point a rod-like item at them. A man is heard telling the worker in Spanish, "You can't do that, and I'm going to shoot." Several agents aimed weapons at the worker, who eventually dropped the item and shuffled toward the edge of the roof. Agents detained at least one worker who was not on the roof, neighbors said. After the agents left, the other workers climbed down, hopped into a vehicle, and drove away. Ms. Valiton was bewildered by it all, especially after an immigration lawyer at the scene told her that many of the workers had work visas. "Why the agents didn't let them stay and finish the freaking job, I don't know," Ms. Valiton said in an interview, complaining about the mess they've left on my property, and adding that she had no insurance on the house. She looked at the leftover construction supplies, including a blue tarp and a ladder propped against her garage. "Now you're hurting the economy," she said. "Now these people are afraid to come back, even though they're here on a work visa." The Department of Homeland Security said in a statement on Thursday that agents arrested one undocumented immigrant at the house and that the other workers, whom the agency described as suspected undocumented immigrants, had refused to comply with agents' commands to come down off the roof. As Ms. Valiton spoke with people on the phone, pacing the sidewalk with a hand over her head, her neighbors looked on with surprise. For some, the episode highlighted the recklessness with which the Trump administration was trying to clamp down on illegal immigration. For others, it was a front-row seat to a crackdown that they fully endorsed, even if it was surprising to see it right across their lawns. "If they're illegal, they gotta get out," said Mac Dunn, 87, who had lived in the neighborhood called University City for more than six decades and supports President Trump's immigration enforcement in the city. "You got to do it right," he said, referring to immigration. "You got here illegally? Well, that's a crime." Nearby, the Morales family, who are Honduran-American, were startled. "This is close to home," said Lestania Morales, the matriarch of the family, and a nurse who was returning home from a shift on Wednesday. She cried as she pulled up to her driveway and discreetly snapped photos of the agents and said she was stunned by the tepid reaction from some of her neighbors. "I don't know which neighbor to trust or not," she said. "It was really hard for me to talk to them when they came outside to watch. This lady over here said, 'Oh, they have to be illegals.' I thought maybe she's on their side, so I just watch what I say around them." Ms. Vallotton's White House sits on a corner lot on Marquette Drive in a racially diverse neighborhood that is home to a mix of longtime white residents, new Honduran homeowners, and young families. It is reflective of just how much the suburb of Kenner, home to 66,000 people, has been transformed by immigrants in the decades since Hurricane Katrina, when many Hispanic people moved to the area and helped it rebuild. But while New Orleans is led by Democrats, the city is surrounded by conservative strongholds, and the Republican governor has welcomed the assistance from federal law enforcement agencies. That has made this Border Patrol operation feel different from the ones that have come to Los Angeles, Chicago, and Charlotte, North Carolina, all led by Gregory Bovino, a senior agency official. As Mr. Bovino and his agents strolled the streets of downtown New Orleans on Wednesday, the friendlier atmosphere was noticeable. In the French Quarter, the city's boozy artery, several people thanked them for their work, though there was still an occasional insult. Ms. Vallotton didn't quite see the issue through a political lens. "She does not identify with either major political party," she said, "and she did not vote in last year's presidential election. But she does see the operation, which the Department of Homeland Security has nicknamed Catahoula Crunch, as unfocused and potentially causing more harm than good. If you've got illegals in the country, then yes, they should be deported back to their country because we don't need more crime," said Ms. Vallotton, who lives with her husband and teenage son. "But you've got people who have been here for decades. These guys are working for a living. They weren't out doing crime. They're spending money in our economy. They're buying groceries. Why are we actively looking for people who are not actively committing crimes at the moment?" she asked. The Border Patrol has said that it is targeting immigrants with criminal histories, but data from past operations shows that most of the people arrested do not have serious criminal records. Ms. Vallotton did not want to share her exact job title at the school where she works, nor the name of the construction company she hired, but she said the presence of Border Patrol agents had already prompted many students to skip school this week. On Wednesday afternoon, she was still scrambling to find someone who could cover her roof. Inside the mobile home on her lawn, she could hear her cat, Humphrey, yowling. Then she looked up at the darkening sky. The forecast for Thursday showed a high chance of rain. You are listening to a reading of articles and features from the New York Times on the Niagara Frontier Radio Reading Service. How Israel's settlement surge in the West Bank is displacing Palestinians. The Israeli government authorized 22 settlements in May, the largest expansion in decades, and Palestinian families are now being forced from their homes. By Nathan Ottenheimer and Fatima Abdul Karim. For two decades, Mohammed Abdul Rahman, 58, lived with his wife and his beehives on a remote hillside in the Israeli-occupied West Bank. But in May, Israeli settlers set up camp about 200 yards away and took control of the road leading to Mr. Abdul Rahman's home, blocking him from returning, he said. Israeli soldiers then evicted him and his wife, Suha Abdul Rahman, the couple said. The Israeli military said that Mr. Abdul Rahman left voluntarily, but he said he has still been unable to return home. Last month, a video shared by an Israeli lawmaker on social media showed his house had been turned into a space for religious study by the settlers. "All my memories are in that home," Mr. Abdul Rahman said by phone last month from his brother's house in the nearby town of Batunia, where he is now staying. "They are not only stealing our land, but also trying to cut the roots that connect us to it." The Abdul Rahmans were among the first Palestinians affected by an Israeli government decision in May to redraw the map of the West Bank by turning more Palestinian areas into Jewish settlements. In the most extensive expansion in decades, the government approved 22 villages and neighborhoods for settlements across the territory, including one called Beit Horon North, near where Mr. Abdul Rahman and his wife lived, west of the Palestinian city of Ramallah. It was part of a broader and decades-long push by Israel to entrench its control over the West Bank. That process has become more aggressive since 2022, when Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu returned to office, and the outbreak of the war in Gaza, which was ignited by the Hamas-led attacks on Israel in October 2023. There has been a surge of settler violence in the West Bank, which Israeli police have largely failed to address. Israel has also conducted extensive military operations, which it has said were aimed at combating militants that have uprooted entire neighborhoods in Palestinian cities. Historians and researchers say that has led to the largest wave of Palestinian displacement in the West Bank in half a century. Most of the international community sees the creation of a Palestinian state that includes the West Bank as key to ending the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. Since capturing the territory in 1967, however, Israel has expanded its presence there through settlement building, even in densely populated Palestinian areas. The government intended to accelerate that process with its decision in May to expand the settlements, according to Israel Gantz, a head of a local settler council who helped promote the plan. The Palestinian Authority, which administers large parts of the West Bank, is also racing to claim territory before Israel does. Say there are 500 acres of land the State of Israel doesn't want to lose. It puts a village there, Mr. Gantz said. That doesn't mean a 500-acre city will be built, but once you're there, no one else can be. The United Nations and the International Court of Justice say that all Israeli settlements in the occupied West Bank area violate international law. Israel rejects that. Some of the 22 settlements approved in May already existed, but they had been deemed illegal under Israeli law. The recent decision meant that these were authorized retroactively. Others are planned for the northern edge of the West Bank, in a region where no officially recognized settlements have existed since Israel dismantled them in 2005. In August, the Israeli government approved a major settlement project known as E1 that would effectively split the West Bank in two, making it harder for Palestinians to establish a contiguous state there. In recent months, members of the Israeli government have also repeatedly threatened to annex parts of the West Bank. Over the past year, settlers have built a record number of outposts, small encampments often made of prefabricated homes, according to an Israeli military official who spoke on the condition of anonymity to share sensitive information. More than 40 were built in the past 6 months alone, according to Hagit Ofran, who monitors the West Bank for Settlement Watch, a project run by the Israeli advocacy group Peace Now. The government's plan for the 22 settlements aims to curb Palestinian urban growth and link Israeli-populated areas, according to Mr. Gantz, who helped select some of the sites. Beit Horon North, for instance, will stop Ramallah from spreading, he added. When we visited Beit Horon North in July, Israeli settlers appeared to be in control of the area. This is our land and I make the rules here, said Elkanah Shahar, a young settler who was wearing a sleeveless shirt with a peace sign. He and a few other boys had been left on a hot morning to watch over a scattering of belongings in the shade of an awning, a worn sofa, a refrigerator, a fan, and bookshelves. The settlers had also poured concrete in preparation for permanent construction. When we approached, one of the settlers drew what appeared to be a handgun that they later said was a pepper spray pistol. "Did you get approval to be here?" Mr. Shahar asked. He demanded that we leave, saying that it was private property. On the same road, two other young Israeli settlers were seen breaking into a recently built Palestinian home that had been abandoned. The gate to the yard was broken and the back window had been shattered. Many settlements grow out of such outposts. A spokesman for the Israeli Civil Administration, a military unit that manages civilian affairs in the West Bank, said that building the Beit Horon North settlement required further legal and planning procedures. The outpost that we visited there was not part of the government-authorized settlement and was illegal, they said, but that taking action against it was subject to the approval of the political echelon. Under the Oslo Accords, signed in the 1990s, both Israelis and Palestinians committed to not take any steps that would change the status of the West Bank. but successive Israeli governments largely ignored dozens of unauthorized Jewish outposts in the region, and the military has often discreetly provided their security, ushering in a period of large-scale settlement expansion. Some remote areas, like the one where Mr. Abdul Rahman lived, were not part of that expansion until this year. "We thought no one paid attention to our patch of land," said Mr. Abdul Rahman. He and his wife lived in an old two-room house built from large, uneven stones, surrounded by pine trees and an olive grove. No other homes were within earshot. Mr. Abdul Rahman said he was ready to fight for his home, and he had filed a complaint with the Israeli police and the Israeli Civil Administration. The police did not respond to a request for comment. "It was not the time for emotions," Mr. Abdul Rahman said. "It's time to put Israel's claim that it's a rule of law country to the test." Ruined rice fields and broken rail lines, Sri Lanka counts cost of cyclone. Officials estimate the damage runs into billions of dollars, a headache for the island nation just recovering from an economic crash. By Mujib Mashal and Pamodi Waravita. As the floodwaters from the devastating cyclone Ditwa recede and families carry out the rites for more than 480 people found dead, Sri Lanka is turning to a different kind of tallying. Gutted rail lines, ravaged fields, washed away roads and bridges, and broken dams. Altogether, the damage could cost the island nation as much as $6 or $7 billion to rebuild, initial estimates by officials show. For a country of modest means, one still emerging from the shadows of a decades-long civil war and a choking economic collapse just 3 years ago, that is a demoralizing task. It is compounded by what is a particularly dispirited moment in international aid, with funding contributions from humanitarian causes plummeting so low, in large part by the precedent set by the United States to pull back as a major donor, that the United Nations has called it an age of indifference. Duminda Hulangamua, the senior economics advisor to Sri Lanka's president, said the government had met with major funding agencies and countries friendly to Sri Lanka on Wednesday, many of whom were helping with relief assistance and had shown a willingness to chip in for reconstruction, but they would all wait for an official assessment of the damage that the World Bank had started, he said. "It's not going to be easy," Mr. Hulangamua said in an interview. Another senior official, Prabhath Chandrakirti, who was Commissioner General of Essential Services, is tasked with coordinating the immediate disaster response, laid out a stark picture of how extensive the devastation has been. "The amount of damage to the country's infrastructure was probably 10 times the damage caused by the Indian Ocean tsunami of 2004, he said in an interview on Thursday. "That tsunami killed tens of thousands and inundated coastal areas, but did not cover the swaths of the country that Cyclone Ditwa did." The country's rail system has faced severe damage, with less than one-third of the 1,000 miles of rail lines operational after the cyclone. Social media videos showed rail lines suspended with the bridges washed away. Mr. Chandrakirti said the extent of damage to the rail system was such that Sri Lanka would need the technical assistance from other countries to rebuild. The economic crash in 2022, caused by corruption and mismanagement of the country's balance of payments, doubled the poverty rate to nearly a quarter of the population. Officials fear that another 10% who were bordering the poverty line could be pushed into it by the cyclone's economic devastation. Loss of livelihoods, rising costs, and service disruptions disproportionately affect low-income households, women, children, and older persons, the country's Disaster Management Center said in a statement. About one-third of Sri Lanka's population makes a living from agriculture. More than 137,000 acres of land that have been destroyed by the floods, along with wrecked dams and canals, have inflicted a heavy economic toll just weeks after rice paddies had been planted. Many farmers, like Abdul Majid Azam, 26, in the country's northern Manar district, have started back at zero. The paddy he had cultivated just weeks ago could not be salvaged. Most of the fertilizer stocks in the market nearby were lost when floodwater gushed through them. In the midday heat, he and two other farmers were back in their fields, still inundated, counting their losses and preparing to plow and plant again. "All of this was destroyed," he said. You are listening to a reading of articles and features from the New York Times. on the Niagara Frontier Radio Reading Service. The diplomat who was accused of sexual abuse but kept his job, President William Ruto, faces pressure after a Times investigation showed that his government downplayed or ignored the mistreatment of women working in Saudi Arabia. By Abdi Latif Dahir and Justin Sheck. Kenya's government received complaints that a diplomat was sexually abusing women, according to a UN official and a labor leader, but officials allowed the diplomat to continue working with migrant women. The diplomat, Robinson Juma Twanga, was the longtime labor attaché in Saudi Arabia. Kenya's president, William Ruto, has built his economic plan around sending more workers abroad. That made Mr. Twanga a powerful figure for the hundreds of thousands of Kenyans, mostly women, working in the kingdom. Hundreds of Kenyan workers have died in Saudi Arabia in recent years. Autopsies describe unexplained injuries and mysterious falls. Many women have reported rape and other physical violence, which often goes unpunished. The New York Times reported this year that women who sought help from the Kenyan embassy said that Mr. Twanga demanded sex and money. Some said that he had told them to become sex workers to pay for plane tickets home. Kenyan officials said at the time that they had not heard such claims. But Kenya's labor ministry received several complaints about Mr. Twanga and discussed how to handle them in 2019, but took no action, according to a UN official. A Kenyan union leader said that in 2020 he reported abuse accusations to the government. Alfred N. Mutua, the labor secretary, would not say what the government knew about the accusations. He said Mr. Twanga retired under the previous administration. Mr. Twanga declined to comment. The Times article prompted an investigation that could lead to criminal charges, Mr. Mutua said. Mr. Mutua encouraged victims to come forward. "We will ensure justice is served," he said. But the administration has delayed releasing records about Mr. Twanga, despite directives from a government watchdog. The years of inaction are another example of how Kenya's government failed to protect women despite evidence of abuse and encouraged even more of them to take jobs in Saudi Arabia. Mr. Ruto's family and political allies profit off the foreign staffing industry. His government has rolled back protections and made it cheaper to send workers abroad. Hundreds of Kenyan children are stranded in Saudi Arabia in a bureaucratic limbo that Kenyan officials have been slow to address. The revelations have prompted rare criticism from within Mr. Ruto's governing coalition. The National Assembly summoned his foreign secretary, who defended the labor program. Senator Faki Mohammed Mwinyahaji said the government treated its citizens like cows for milking. "If they bring money, that's the only time we are happy," he said. "Once they get problems abroad, we never help them." In a meeting with the International Labor Organization in December 2019, Kenyan labor officials acknowledged receiving reports of sex abuse by Mr. Twanga, said a senior United Nations official who attended the meeting. The official, who spoke on condition of anonymity to discuss private conversations, said Kenyan officials urged overseas diplomats to monitor Mr. Twanga. By 2020, numerous women had reported that Mr. Twanga had solicited sex, said Francis Atwoli, the head of Kenya's Central Organization of Trade Unions. He said he had relayed the complaints to officials, including the labor secretary at the time, Simon Kiprono Chilungwi. Mr. Atwoli also told journalists at a 2021 news conference that a Kenyan official in Saudi Arabia had demanded sex from a woman. Mr. Atwoli did not name the official then, but recently told the Times that it was Mr. Twanga. "Nothing ever happened," Mr. Atwoli said. "It's not a secret that he was problematic." Mr. Chilugwe did not respond to requests for comment. Rosaline Kathuri Njogu, a senior foreign ministry official, said that no formal complaint had been filed. "If a government employee acts in this manner, that is not only unconscionable, it is patently criminal," she said on a radio show. Francis Wahome, a lobbyist for Kenya's staffing industry, said several women had complained that Mr. Twanga coerced them into sex. Mr. Wahome said he believed that the sex was consensual. Since the Times reported on Mr. Twanga, other women said in interviews that he insulted them, denied help, or told them to engage in sex work. Pauline Mutoni Kariuki said her Saudi employer and his friend raped her in 2020. she became pregnant and sought help. At the embassy, she said, Mr. Twanga accused her of seducing men. Everlene John said she went to the embassy after her Saudi employer withheld pay and threatened to rape and kill her. You think you will get a red carpet when you come to the embassy? She recalls Mr. Twanga asking. She said he told her if she was unhappy at work, she should consider sex work. The Times obtained an international government report portraying Kenya's embassy in Riyadh as mired in turmoil, with the ambassador accusing his staff of acting unethically. Mr. Mutua, the labor secretary, said he had sent new attachés to Saudi Arabia. I am confident that the teams that are on the ground now are much better, he said. UN warns of another wave of atrocities in Sudan's civil war. Paramilitary groups have intensified an offensive on a crucial region bordering Darfur, prompting fears of another massacre. By Pranav Bhaskar. The UN's top human rights official warned on Thursday of another wave of atrocities in Sudan's civil war as paramilitary groups intensify an offensive on an oil-rich, crucial region bordering Darfur. In October, one of the groups, the Rapid Support Forces, seized the famine-stricken city of Al-Fashir from the Sudanese military, unleashing widespread violence against civilians. Heavy fighting has now surged across the sprawling Kordofan region, which connects central Sudan to Darfur. It is truly shocking to see history repeating itself in Kordofan so soon after the horrific events in Al-Fashir, said Volker Türk, the UN human rights chief. We must not allow Kordofan to become another Al-Fashir. The region is important for both sides in the conflict. To regain its territorial foothold in Darfur, the Sudanese military will need to secure key routes through Kordofan. Control of the region would allow the Rapid Support Forces to build on its momentum and choke the flow of movement between the center of the country and Darfur. Nearly 40,000 people have been displaced in the state of North Kordofan, according to the International Organization for Migration, where paramilitary forces captured the city of Bara in late October. The UN has documented deaths from aerial strikes, shelling, and summary executions, and believes the number of civilian casualties is likely to be much higher than what is being officially recorded. In West Kordofan, the Rapid Support Forces said on Monday that it had claimed the town of Babnusa, a key economic center. The Sudanese Armed Forces denied on Tuesday that it had lost control of Babnusa, saying that fighting was still taking place. And in South Kordofan, civilians in the town of Kadugli and Diling have been trapped in siege conditions, according to UNICEF, with those trying to escape facing dangerous conditions. The UN said it received reports of a drone strike by the Sudanese military in South Kordofan on Saturday, which killed at least 48 people. Separately, the Sudan Doctors Network, a medical advocacy group, said in a statement on Thursday that a strike by the Rapid Support Forces on a kindergarten killed 9 people, including 4 children. Sudan's long-running civil war is widely considered one of the world's worst humanitarian crises. The fighting has raged for more than 2 years, forcing 12 million people from their homes and left as many as 400,000 people dead by some estimates. The UN Migration Agency estimates that nearly 100,000 people have fled Al-Fashir in recent weeks, but only about 10,000 have arrived in Tawila, the nearest city with a sizable international aid presence. On the way out of Al-Fashir, civilians have faced gunfire and abductions. And her last article today, the heist of its culinary crown jewels rocks a French village. Shop owners say the thieves who took 990 pounds of snails must have been escargot cognoscenti. By Efrat Livni. It was not quite the Louvre heist, but for a village in northeastern France, the recent theft of more than $100,000 worth of escargot from a local farm, just as prime holiday snail-eating season begins, was pretty close. The family that owns the business believes that the target, and especially the timing, suggests that whoever did it had an insider's knowledge of the esoteric escargot industry. The French eat about 37 million pounds of snails every year, according to the National Heliculture Federation of France, which represents snail farmers. Much of this consumption happens around Christmas and the New Year, as evidenced by the inevitable annual appearance of holiday escargot recipes in French magazines. The heist appears to have been timed to coincide with this period of exceptional demand. Escargot is quite a rare dish. It is pricey and it is usually served for Christmas or big events, said Inez d'Auvergne, 20, who works in her family's snail enterprise and whose father, Jean Mathieu, discovered last week that they had been robbed of almost their entire holiday stock. We think they were people who know, a connoisseur or professional, to be able to steal 1 year's worth of stock at just this time, she said. On November 24th, she said, her father went to work as usual at L'Escargot de Grand Creuse, the business his parents started in 1999. It now consists of a snail farm, shop, labs, and kitchens, and that morning it was obvious as soon as he arrived that something was amiss. The door of the shop was open. The doors to the kitchens and the labs, where cooking and cultivation experimentation happen, were also open, and drawers in the office were emptied of petty cash. Most alarming, nearly all the escargot, 990 pounds of fresh and frozen snails, were gone. That stock was meant to get them through the high demand of the holiday season. Just before Christmas, we find ourselves without much, Ms. Duverne said. The police have no suspects yet, she said, and the family is scrambling to contend with the loss. The Duvernes are among only several hundred snail farming families in France, where the supply of the mollusks in the wild has been depleted. Regulations limit gathering them, and cultivation does not meet demand. People have been eating snails for at least 170,000 years, and snails have been a snack in the Mediterranean for about 30,000. They are relished in Italy, Spain, North Africa, parts of Asia, and the Caribbean. Much of the growth of the global snail market, valued at about $700 million annually by some estimates, is driven by demand for the mollusks in skin care. Snail mucin is hot in Korean beauty products and a booming international business, as well as in pharmaceuticals and in food. In France, local growers account for only about 5% of the market, according to the National Snail Farming Federation. Small French snail producers say they struggle against bigger producers abroad and face tricky conditions. During COVID lockdowns, for example, critical holiday sales plummeted. The Duvernes produce about 350,000 snails annually, selling them online, in markets, and to high-end clients like Le Parc, a restaurant with 2 Michelin stars in nearby Reims. They are part of a network of cultivators serving the regional businesses that cater to the many wine tourists passing through. Their snail farm is itself a tourist attraction, promising an escargot tasting and a presentation on cultivating mollusks. Because it takes about a year for snails to reach maturity, there is no way to make up for the losses from the theft in time for the Christmas rush, Ms. Duvern said. Fellow snail raisers have shown solidarity, she said, offering supplies to help the family meet its contractual obligations. The family learned of the world's interest in their plight after customers told them of news reports from across France, Europe, and Asia. Ms. Duvern said she hoped that people hearing her family's story would support other small businesses and farmers. There is one bright spot, she noted. The producer snails, which lay eggs, were not taken in the theft, perhaps because they cannot be sold for immediate consumption. The family can plan on cultivating and raising a new supply of escargot. Next year, if the season is good, Ms. Duvern said. You've been listening to a reading of articles and features from the Friday, December 5th issue of the New York Times. Your reader has been Chris Wilhelm. Thank you for listening.